Whether you're shopping for grads, getting an early gift for dad, or just looking for a little something new or used for your shelf, you'll find it at HPB. And you'll get almost everything for an extra 20% off during the big sale at Half Price Books this Memorial Day weekend. Saturday, May 25th through Monday, May 27th, save big in-store at your local Half Price Books and at HPB.com. Offer cannot be combined with other coupons. Exclusions apply. To learn more, visit HPB.com.
MSW Media.
Welcome to Teacher Quit Talk. I'm Miss Redacted.
And I'm Mrs. Frazzled. Every week we explore the teacher exodus to find out what, if anything, could get these educators back in the classroom.
We've all had our moments where we thought, what the hell am I doing here? From burnout to bureaucracy to soul-sucking stressors and creative dead ends.
From recognizing when it was time to go to navigating feelings of guilt and regret afterwards, we're here to cut out the gaslighting and get real about what it means to leave teaching.
We've got insights from former teachers from all over the country who have seen it all. So get ready to be disturbed. Join us on Teacher Quit Talk to laugh through the pain of the U.S. education system. We'll see you there.
The rule of law is not just some lawyer's turn of phrase. It is the very foundation of our democracy. The essence of the rule of law is that like cases are treated alike. That there not be one rule for Democrats and another for Republicans, one rule for the powerful, another for the powerless, one rule for the rich and another for the poor, or different rules depending upon one's race or ethnicity. To serve as Attorney General at this critical time is a calling I am honored and eager to answer.
So yeah, now it's clean up on aisle 45 time. And for a long while yet, it is going to be clean up on aisle 45.
And welcome back to Clean Up on Aisle 45, episode number 6. I'm Andrew Torres.
And I'm AG. How are you, Andrew?
I am fantastic. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm good. I'm really good. Today was Christmas for me.
And why, he asks, giving her an opening, was today Christmas for you?
Well, because the Supreme Court of the United States, the big one, the one where Trump nominated 3 judges, decided to not hear the round 2 of Mazar's case, subpoena case that Cy Vance filed. Now, this isn't the Mazar's case that the House filed, but the one that the Manhattan District Attorney filed. And in not hearing and refusing to hear that case, that means the lower court ruling stands, which means Mazar's has to fork it over.
Yeah, that is exactly right. I suspected we might talk about that a little bit, but before we dive into that, I just want to share for those listeners that missed it, we had our first live Patreon hangout and Q&A last Friday over Zoom. We went for over an hour. We answered the questions that people submitted and voted on, and then our fans stayed on the line for they could still be there as far as I know, right? Like
it was at least 2 hours, because when I started my Zoom happy hour for the Daily Beans, I had to end the other meeting. It was still going on. So
I love that. That was super cool.
Yeah, that's why, because I have the one Zoom account, and come 4 Pacific time on Fridays, I have to start that second show.
Yeah. It's a little different than the way we do it on opening arguments. It was a lot of fun. It was really, really, really cool. So both the video of that and the audio are up on the Patreon feed over patreon.com/aisle45pod. And if you support the show at any level, you'll get that first Q&A. It's supposed to be a $2 perk, but, you know, we wanted to share it with anybody who's just given us a buck.
Yep, absolutely. And I honestly had a really good time. And you can also join us. You can join Andrew and me on the Stereo app, which happens every Tuesday at 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 Eastern. That's also a load of fun.
Yep.
And that's for the public. So you can join that on the public.
Yeah. Yeah. Anybody can do that. So. All right. So we ready to tackle Mazar's?
We are. And a little bit earlier, I asked you, please send me a copy of the original subpoena. I was having a hard time finding it buried in all the news today. And there was a very specific reason I wanted to see the copy of that subpoena. Now, we know that Vance has been investigating this for 2 years-ish, right? This thing has been in court for a long time. And if you want to set this up, Andrew, and talk about the history of the Mazars subpoena as an intro to what I'm about to postulate. I'm about to put some beans on something with what kind of documents Cy Vance is after, because while Trump's tax returns, personal and business, are included in that subpoena, I don't think that's what he was an after.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, then I'm going to blaze quickly through the background because I'm dying to know what that is. So here's the story. Early 2019, Cyrus Vance, district attorney for Manhattan, impaneled a grand jury in Manhattan, and they issued a subpoena to Mazars USA. That's the accounting firm that handles Trump's taxes. They were for 8 years of Trump's personal and corporate tax returns and other financial records. And I guess we're going to get the drill down from AG with respect to that. So 2011 to the present. So it's now 9 years, right? Grand juries, as everybody listening to the show already knows, are confidential. So we don't know the full scope of what they're looking at. But given that this has been litigated and given some of the things that Vance has said publicly in court, right, in defending the subpoena, we know that at minimum the office was examining potential state insurance, tax, and bank fraud charges. And that's always been my assumption. A story broke in late December in the New York Times that Vance and his office had interviewed several Deutsche Bank, that's Trump's bank, and Aon, that's Trump's insurer, employees. So it's still kind of a black box, but that's how this began. Even though the subpoena was addressed to Mazars, and this is a very common thing to do, Mazars basically said, we'll do whatever the court tells us to do. Trump intervened, asserted executive privilege. You said, we said, everybody with a brain said, that's a fucking nonsense argument. And basically, so did the District Court for the Southern District of New York, and so did the Second Circuit on Appeal. And then the Supreme Court in July. And now, mind you, right, this is all pretty, that is moving at the speed of light for a judicial determination. The Supreme Court ruled in July that although the president could assert the normal defenses available to any person resisting a subpoena, he didn't get superpowers because he was the president, right? And that was a 7-2 decision, right? This was not close. Yes, that was still in the RBG days, but it was still not at all close. I came on your show that day to say, look, this means that Cy Vance could potentially see Trump's taxes before the November election. Now, we know that it didn't quite happen that way, but I want to remind people how close we got, right? It went back down for a hearing on the defenses available to ordinary people, which, shocker, just as I said, your ordinary people defenses are really, really not good, right? Like, by and large, people have to comply with subpoenas that are issued by grand juries, right?
Yeah, and as soon as we read it, we're like, this isn't going to win either.
Yeah, and so, again, same proceeding. District court said, yep, we've heard it. We've listened. Trump tried to amend. There was like a bunch of garbage. But basically, the district court was like, nope-a-roo, went up to the Second Circuit. The Second Circuit said, nope-a-roo. And then on October 13th, that's when Trump appealed to the Supreme Court, filed a petition for writ of certiorari, and also separately moved for an emergency order staying the Second Circuit's judgment, right? And you have to do that because otherwise, presumptively, like, court decisions take effect once they're ruled, right? And so his standard was the same that you would need to meet to get an injunction, right? That is, you have to show irreparable harm, which he had a decent argument on, right? It you have to show that this can't be fixed. And the idea that, like, you couldn't put the genie back in the bottle once somebody has seen your tax records of criming, probably a good point, although not sure how much you want to lean into that one.
Yeah, well, I mean, you and I kind of trashed the irreparable harm thing by saying these weren't being released to the public. They were being released to a grand jury.
And that was the counter argument, was grand juries keep it confidential. There was some case law that basically says, yeah, but, you know, prosecutors aren't always the most tightly lipped. Whatever. It wasn't a ridiculous argument on irreparable harm. Where it was ridiculous was on likelihood of success on the merits, which was zero. Right. Yeah. Their position was utterly without legal merit. And you have to balance those two things. Right. Like, the more likely you are to win, the less the showing of irreparable harm and vice versa.
It's weighted. Right.
Yeah,
it's weighted.
Exactly right. So Cy Vance struck a deal. And this is a deal that I would have taken at the time. Basically said, okay, look, while you're briefing this to the Supreme Court, we won't enforce the subpoena, but we want an expedited briefing schedule, right? And they did. The motion was filed on the 13th, and all briefing was concluded on the 19th, right? So again, that is making lawyers work overtime on the weekend, right? And the weird thing was, then it just sat. And despite being 7-2, so bear with me, on October 20th, the Supreme Court could have said nope, which is what they did today, right? But instead, they sat on it for 4 months. One might infer a John Roberts-related, we don't want to influence the election, I don't know. But it went until today, and today the Supreme Court said, we're not granting the, quote, emergency relief you requested 4 months ago. And again, this is a 9-0, right? There are no written dissents. It's 100% straightforward. There is still the case on the merits that the Supreme Court will have the opportunity to review. But Mazars is going to turn over those documents. They said that they will. There's now nothing to stop Cy Vance's office from enforcing them, and he can now move with respect to enforcing the subpoena, meaning that at long last, the grand jury will see Trump's personal and corporate tax records. But you have some beans.
I sure do, Andrew. And here's my beans. If you look at the subpoena, it says it asks for three things: tax returns and related schedules in draft as filed and amended form. It also asks for any and all statements of financial condition, annual statements, periodic financial reports, and independent auditor's reports prepared, compiled, reviewed, or audited by Mazars USA LLP or its predecessor, Wiser Mazars LLP. And third, regardless of time period, any and all engagement agreements or contracts related to the preparation, compilation, review, or auditing of the documents described in items A and B. Now, we know from public reporting that we reported over on our show that Vance has had documents production coming from Deutsche Bank for over a year. We also know that there's no way he doesn't have the state tax returns from New York State, and he's had them for a long time. We also have the New York Times indelible reporting who got a hold of their tax returns and was looking at those as well. Those three things say to me that Vance kept this Mazars case going. If he was only after the tax documents, or if he could have gotten it from where he already, from documents he already has, he would have dropped this suit. He was like, I'm wasting my time. He didn't. Oh, and by the way, shout out to those who don't trust Cy Vance. If you think he would have hung around and done this much work and expanded the investigation and stayed in this court battle with Mazars for 2 years and subpoenaed a property tax firm this week and then hired Pomerantz, a former U.S. attorney from the Southern District of New York, if you think that he's thinking of dropping this case, and he would not have done any of that. So you can get that idea out of your head. Now, here's what I think. I don't think he's looking. There was some sort of, and I said this, God, I said this a year ago. There's some sort of smoking gun document that they think Mazars has that could help prove intent, right? Because, Andrew, you have even said that, and I've talked to Ellie Honig too, that a defense could be, hey, I'm the CEO. I don't get involved at that level. My tax accountants are responsible for that. My lawyers told me it was okay. I was under the impression it was fine because my accountant said it was fine. But if there's some sort of memo or amended tax return or letter of intent to file or something from Mazars, his accounting firm, recommending, hey, maybe don't take that easement deduction on Seven Springs Estates because you use it as private land. Or, hey, maybe you're, I've noticed here that your valuation of your property is different than what it's registered at with Zillow. I don't know. Some sort of a memo to Trump or the Trump organization saying, I'm warning you, this isn't legit. And Trump says to go ahead and file it anyway. That is the kind of documentation, I think. And I have no proof of this other than what I've told you based on my speculation. That's what I think Vance is waiting for from Mazars. And I mean,
so I think that's super. I think that is very, it is a very lawyerly approach to what would count as a smoking gun. And let's sort of spin this out a little bit. If you had two separate tax returns, right? If you had a draft tax return for 2014 that differed wildly from the actual form that was filed in 2014, then even in the absence of the smoking gun email, right, that's a signal to Vance to subpoena a witness and to bring in the person who prepared that tax return, whose signature name will be at the bottom, and to say, hey, you prepared the draft, right? Yeah, this was it. And you prepared this according to the best of your abilities and with information provided to you by Donald J. Trump. Uh-huh. And you gave it to him. And then what happened? Why did you change it? And that person will have every incentive to say, well, the person who told me to change it told me that X were the facts, right? Like, you will get the situation because Donald Trump, because you know what Donald Trump is going to say, right? Donald Trump is going to say exactly what you predicted that he was going to say. That's what the accountants do. That's what they did. And, and they said that this was the right way to approach it. And getting somebody to flip on Trump, because if they do nothing, right, then they're now the ones, right? Like, somebody changed that tax return. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and Mazars is going to have on file to protect and cover their own asses any letters that they sent to the Trump organization or
exactly.
Any subsidiary thereof saying, we don't recommend that you, for example, take the easement deduction on Seven Springs Estates. We are going to go ahead and file on your discretion. We waive liability for this. Sign below. De-de-der. That exists if in fact that's what happens, and Mazars will be more than happy to provide that information, because they're not going to take a bullet for Donald on Fifth Avenue. No way.
I couldn't agree more. Couldn't have said it better myself, so I won't say anything else.
All right, sweet. Well, we have some more information from SCOTUS. We do have to take a quick break, so everybody hang out. We'll be right back.
Hey everybody, it's AG for Cleanup on Aisle 45. Do you ever listen to the podcast and want to scream your opinions at us, or just sing to us, or ask us questions? Well, now you can. We are going live on the Stereo app, where you can ask us your questions directly. So join us for the Cleanup on Aisle 45 After Party Q&A. We have uncensored opinions, exclusive content, and it's all only available on the Stereo app. I love the Stereo app. I'm on the app talking all the time. Follow me and get notified every time I go live. You can follow me at Allison Gill. And we take deep dives into a variety of topics, and we interact directly with you. And so you download the Stereo app. It's free. And then you follow me at stereo.com/AllisonGill. So actually go to stereo.com/AllisonGill to set up an account. It's free to do. There's a link in the description of the show, too. Then join us over on the Stereo app. The Stereo app has thousands of live social conversations, a wide range of genres. It's not just us. There's tons of conversations going on. News, comedy, sports, and just everything. And you choose whether you can be a co-host or participate as a guest or just listen on exclusive conversations. So join Andrew and me every Tuesday at 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern on the Stereo app. And you can look for Andrew at Torres and me at Allison Gill. We'll see you there.
All right, everybody, welcome back. A couple other things going on with the Supreme Court today. Andrew, what were some of the other cases that were that had decisions? And I do you call them decisions or actions?
Yeah, yeah. So decisions on orders today, right?
Yep.
So, right. So granting cert, denying cert, incomprehensible dissents that were written. So we started off with some good news. So... yeah.
Yeah. Oh, and I did want to make one thing clear, too, because a lot of folks are wondering, oh, great, the public is going to get to see these tax returns. That's not how it works. These tax returns are going to go directly to the grand jury. However, if there is a speaking indictment or any crimes indicted, you will find out what it was that was a crime. Don't worry.
Yep. That is exactly right. And trials are public.
Hello.
So, you know, unless Donald Trump plea bargains, which strikes me as super duper unlikely in a case like this, that information will get out to us at some point. So, all right. So that was all. That's the A block. Let's leave that behind. That was good news about the Supreme Court. Now let me throw a big bucket of cold water on you. Remind you that 2/3 of the Supreme Court, 6 votes, are lifelong, hidebound, hard right conservatives. And yes, that includes Chief Justice Roberts as the so-called center. And 5 of the 9 are unambiguously on board with using the court as a naked vehicle for right-wing judicial activism. That's what we call the howler monkey contingent over at Opening Arguments. Clarence Thomas, Samuel Alito, Brett Kavanaugh, Neil Gorsuch, and Amy Coney Barrett. But, A.G., among the howler monkeys, who's the howleriest?
Scalia?
Scalia will always be a good idea. The ghost of Scalia.
Thomas,
will always
it's Justice Thomas.
Yeah, it's if were it not for the only argument against Thomas and his closest competitor is Sam Alito, right? The only argument against Clarence Thomas is that when it comes to voting rights cases in which the open criterion was suppression of African American votes, which happens a terrifying amount of times, you know, where public officials will say, like, no, you don't understand. We don't want the N-words voting, right? Like, that happens in real cases. Other than Clarence Thomas joining in on those sorts of cases, it's Thomas. Today's Supreme Court orders confirm his widening lead over Sam Alito as the howleriest of the howler monkey contingent. Here are the two cases where the Supreme Court denied cert today. They were private citizen election cases. They're captioned Republican Party of Pennsylvania versus Veronica DeGraffenried, the acting secretary of Pennsylvania, and Jake Corman, and I don't know who Jake Corman is, but versus the Pennsylvania Democratic Party et al. Case numbers 20-542 and 20-574.
You know, Jake.
Yeah. They're part of what I've called the rat-fucking cases in Pennsylvania, okay? And what happened here was, and I came on your show to talk about this, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, okay, upheld State Board of Elections regulations that said, hey, since, you know, we live in a plague-infested hellhole dystopia, when you're mailing in your ballots, we can count ballots that are postmarked by election day, but received up to 3 days later. And again, with what Louis DeJoy did with the USPS, those could have been mailed a month earlier, 2 months earlier. That went all the way up to the Supreme Court. This was Amy Coney Barrett was on the court, but took no part in this initial consideration. So the court split 4-4 and basically said, we'll see. We'll do nothing. We're not going to disturb your ruling, Pennsylvania Supreme Court, but we do want you to segregate the mail-in ballots that you received after Election Day and keep them separate from the ones that you received on or before Election Day. And look, you do not have to be a conspiracy theorist to see what the hell was going on there, right? if Biden had won by a smaller margin in Pennsylvania, right, he won by 80,000 votes, 1.15%, right? But if it had been a much smaller margin, and if Pennsylvania had been the margin of victory in the Electoral College, then the Howler Monkey contingent was very clearly protecting their right to basically overturn the election.
It was a thing, right, where if the segregated mail-in ballots would not have made a difference in either the Pennsylvania numbers or the national numbers, then it would be mooted?
You would think, right? And that is, in fact, what six, but only six, Supreme Court justices have thought.
Oh, my God, because you and I thought it was going to be mooted by, like, unanimously.
I would have wagered any amount of money that this would have been a 9-0. It was not, and we're going to get to that. To take your catchphrase, we actually did vote in numbers too big for them to manipulate.
Indeed.
Just barely. If Biden had lost Georgia, that's, as we all know, 11,779 votes. And then either Arizona, which he won by 10,000, or the Omaha Congressional District, which he won by 22,000, then we would have been in the rat fuck scenario,
mm-hmm.
right? And it would have gone back to the Supreme Court. Biden could have won by 7 million votes, and we would have potentially been looking at a Bush v. Gore 2 in front of this Supreme Court. So that's terrifying. Do not let up.
No, right.
We have to vote in numbers too big.
We warned of that, yep. too, right? I didn't see it coming down to the segregated ballots coming in after, you know, Election Day and having that number be smaller than the Biden victory. I didn't know what it was going to be, but I was absolutely terrified that if it were very close with the Howler Monkey contingency in the Supreme Court, that we would have ended up with another Brooks Brothers riot.
Yeah. So good news, that didn't happen. And so today, the slightly less howlerier contingent, right, teamed up with the grown-ups on the court to reject the cert petitions in the Pennsylvania ratfuck cases, because, duh, they're obviously moot, right? But as I previewed for you, there were three dissents. Well, there were two dissents, three dissenting justices, right? One was from Alito and Gorsuch, and it claims that these cases aren't really moot under a really narrow standing doctrine called capable of repetition yet otherwise evading review. And let me explain, like, that doctrine, pretty much the only cases in which you see it applied are abortion cases, right? Because if you would say, well, you know, sorry, took 3 years for us to hear your appeal, and, you know, the gestational age of a fetus is 40 weeks, so, you know, you would then never have a plaintiff, or you would never have a party be able to get Supreme Court review on any abortion case, because, you know, people do not carry fetuses for 3 years, right? So that's why, and I can't come up with, other than abortion cases, I can't come up with another case in which the Supreme Court, I know there are, I don't mean to suggest it's only an abortion doctrine, but I do mean to suggest it's a super narrow doctrine for standing, right? Usually you have to show something structural that means why we can't consider this if it ever comes up again. So, okay. That's the argument being made in the Alito-Gorsuch dissent, that every time we have an election, this might come up and it'll be too late. And so we ought to just decide it now. It's a bad argument, but it's not a criminally insane argument.
Wow. That's six. Wow. Okay.
But I haven't gotten to the bad part yet. Are you ready? Are you ready for the bad part?
Yep, I'm ready for the bad part.
So this is the Clarence Thomas, incomprehensible dissent. And I want to try and convey to you just how bad this opinion is, right? So something that left, right, and center, everybody pretty much agrees on, for better or for worse, is that unless the state is violating core constitutional rights, states have wide latitude in how they run their elections, right? And look, Republicans have been taking advantage of that for 70 years in deep red states to disenfranchise voters who look an awful lot like Clarence Thomas, right? But that's not good enough for the Republicans anymore, because Republicans are so deeply unpopular, they're losing everywhere across the country, that it's not enough for them to just rig elections in states that have red governors, red state legislators, and red Supreme Courts. There's not enough of those states anymore. The math doesn't add up. So this cycle saw a number of conflicts in purple states like Pennsylvania and Wisconsin, where gerrymandered conservative state legislatures, right, would pass laws trying to restrict voting during a fucking pandemic. And then Democratic governors would step in and Democratic executive agencies would say, all right, that's all true, but in the case of COVID-19, we're going to give you 3 extra days. We're going to liberalize our mail-in requirements, that sort of thing. And then it would go up to the state Supreme Court for a final determination. Is that a valid exercise of the executive's powers over our state laws, right? And you would think the party of federalism, the party of let the states figure it out, would be happy with that result.
Yeah, but so many of their lawsuits were like, no, it has to be decided by the legislature. It can't be decided by the Supreme Court of that state. It has to be by the legislature. That's what the Constitution says. Meh, meh, meh.
And that position, the idea that the U.S. Supreme Court would tell a state Supreme Court that its interpretation of its state laws is inappropriate would cause our slave-owning founding fathers to rise up zombie-like from the graves with torches and pitchforks.
Well, isn't this dividing by zero? Because, I mean, you're saying, no, the state Supreme Court can't. It's only the state legislatures, says me, the Supreme Court.
Yeah, it's I like the dividing by zero analogy because I can't come up with anything
else. It makes my head explode. Like
it should.
You just told me that the only people who can set our rules are the state legislatures, and you just set that rule, and you're not the state legislature.
Yeah, no, it's like that old episode of Star Trek.
You're pubic hair on the Coke can guy. You're not my state legislature.
Yeah. Here's Clarence Thomas's argument. I want to quote him directly. Quote, the Constitution gives each state legislature authority to determine the, quote, manner of federal elections, Article 1, Section 4. Yet, both before and after the 2020 election, non-legislative officials in various states took it upon themselves to set the rules instead. As a result, we received an unusually high number of petitions contesting those changes. These cases provide us with an ideal opportunity to address just what authority non-legislative officials have to set election rules. Who the fuck are you to do that for the state of Pennsylvania? And where, what happened to, we're just calling balls and strikes here?
I have an answer for Clarence Thomas. The answer is, not you, bro.
Yeah, right.
That's who. Not you.
This is not the standard the Supreme Court has used in any of the Voting Rights Act cases, as you might imagine. It only became a thing because Trump's arguments in these cases were so bad that even deep red state Supreme Courts were like, we're not touching this, Sidney Powell, go away.
9 Trump-appointed judges in district and appellate court were like, yep, nah.
Yeah. It's terrible. So Thomas's position got one vote, and that's good, right? But look, it is significant when an argument this bad gets set down in writing, even in a dissent that is just one vote, right? This is something that future cases will be able to cite in a dissent as if this were a reasonable construction of the law, and it is not. Oh, and can I also add, Clarence Thomas said a whole bunch of other terrible stuff in his opinion that makes me think he's a QAnon supporter who listens to Newsmax on continuous loop?
Well, his wife helped bus a bunch of people to the insurrection rally. So, I mean, he's got to go. Dude's got to go.
He's got to go. He writes, and I'll spare you the full and exact quotes, but he has a long screed about how voting by mail has, quote, become more permissive, end of quote, and That expansion impedes post-election judicial review because litigation about mail-in ballots is substantially more complicated. For one thing, as election administrators have long agreed, the risk of fraud is vastly more prevalent for mail-in ballots.
Oh, hang on. I've got my pearls. Hold on. I've got my pearls right here.
Oh, gosh.
Let me clutch them real quick.
I love that you have the actual pearls right there. That is so you. That citation to fraud being vastly more prevalent for mail-in ballots is, of course, to an opinion piece in the New York Times.
It's
right?
A big lie.
It of course it's a lie, but it is now a lie written down in an actual dissent signed by an actual Supreme Court justice. I want to say it gets worse, and here's the worse. At the end, quote, in short, the post-election system of judicial review is, at most, suitable for garden variety disputes. It is often incapable of testing allegations of systematic maladministration, voter suppression, or fraud that go to the heart of public confidence in election results. And you're going to say, oh, you're not telling me that Clarence Thomas thinks the election was stolen. I'm going to tell you it's worse than that. I'm going to read, and again, these are word for words, what Clarence Thomas wrote in print at the United States Supreme Court. Quote, this is obviously problematic for allegations backed by substantial evidence, but the same is true where allegations are incorrect. After all, confidence in the integrity of our electoral process is essential to the functioning of our participatory democracy. So, yes, that is Clarence Thomas saying, look, even if they're making it up, even if there's zero evidence behind any of these claims, the fact that they've made the claims is why the Supreme Court should deal with them. This is mind-boggling to see even Clarence Thomas saying something like this.
I don't even get it.
I'm with you.
He's saying, even though I'm lying, you could believe it, and therefore mail-in voting can be fraudulent.
And an incorrect allegation left to fester without a robust mechanism to test and disprove it. Now, why the state Supreme Court telling you no is not a robust mechanism is left unsaid.
Or 64 losses in court.
Drives honest citizens out of the democratic process and breeds distrust of our government. So in other words, this is the Ted Cruz position now written into the law. Like, I'm not saying there's evidence, but I'm saying the fact that people think there's evidence means that people don't trust the government, means that we need the Supreme Court to step in. It's insane.
Ladies and gentlemen, I would like to welcome you to the newest agency, the fourth branch of government. It's called the Perception Supreme Court. Everybody, welcome. See, here, facts don't matter. Perception is 9/10 of the law. Next up on the docket, is the sky blue? No! Bill thinks it's red, and perception is 9/10 of the law. Moving on to the next case.
I want to get t-shirts made that says perception is 9/10 of the law.
That's my new ad-libbed game show. I just came up with it off the top of my head.
I think
it's great. I think Perception Supreme Court is where Clarence Thomas sits.
Yeah. There are no fabulous prizes, though.
No. You win Supreme voter Court. Suppression and a trail outside of democracy. Welcome. Of course, Mike Lee's all good with that. He thinks democracy is rank and the opponent of liberty. But, you know.
Look. I did not expect we would be headed that way that quickly, but I think Republicans are just good enough at math to know that if it's ever subject to a straight popular vote ever again, that their position is not tenable. So going to get worse before it gets better.
Yeah, well, the pendulum has to swing, as Ruth Bader Ginsburg said. Just that that arc of the moral universe is long and justice grinds slow, right? As we know.
I miss her.
I know, me too. Speaking of Mike Lee, he had some really fantastic questions today for Merrick Garland during the Attorney General confirmation hearings. It started in the Senate Judiciary Committee, which is no longer chaired by Lindsey Graham. Sorry, you burnt. And we're going to talk a little bit about the Merrick Garland confirmation hearings right after this quick break. So stay with us.
Hey everybody, it's AG. Calling all cereal lovers, this one is for you. This segment of Cleanup on Aisle 45 is brought to you by Magic Spoon, a cereal so delicious you will not believe it's healthy. I have been a huge cereal fan my whole life. I used to plop down in front of Saturday morning cartoons, eat like a whole box pretty much, and then drink the delicious milk afterwards. But as an adult, I've been avoiding it because of all of the chemicals and sugar and carbs, just stuff I don't want in my body. But Magic Spoon is different. It's so delicious you will not believe it's made without all the sugar, carbs, or guilt. And Forbes magazine says, with cereal that tastes this good and offers so much nutritional value, as opposed to, well, none, Magic Spoon may be the future of breakfast. And I couldn't agree more. Magic Spoon cereals amazingly have zero sugar, 12 grams of protein, and only 3 net grams of carbs in each serving. It is, deep breath, keto-friendly, gluten-free, grain-free, soy-free, low-carb, high-protein, and GMO-free. And the best part, it's really, really delicious. It is like, it's so good. And they have 4 amazing flavors, vintage to the core, right? They got cocoa, fruity, frosted, and blueberry. And it tastes incredible. Honestly, too good to be true, but it is real. My favorite flavor right now is blueberry. It is so yummy. I even snack on it dry as a treat. It's just, it's delicious. And it's healthy and nutritious, and it's guilt-free. So go to magicspoon.com/cleanup to grab a variety pack. You can try all 4 flavors today. Be sure to use our promo code CLEANUP at checkout to get free shipping. Magic Spoon is so confident in their product, and so am I, that it is backed with a 100% happiness guarantee. So if you don't like it for any reason, they will refund all your money. No questions asked. That's magicspoon.com/cleanup. And use code CLEANUP for free shipping. And we thank Magic Spoon for sponsoring the podcast.
And we're back from the break. And AG, just as we were about to leave, you teased our listeners with the only person who calls Ted Cruz a friend, Mike Lee. what the heck happened with him?
The guy who goes to the Ted Cruz Emporium of Vampire Haircuts.
Yeah.
the Ted Cruz Rush Limbaugh Emporium of Vampire Haircuts. Yeah, he was asking today questions of, well, first of all, Merrick Garland. Awesome, incredible job today. I can't, but he batted 1,000. Most of the things the Republicans wanted to talk about were the Russia hoax and nominees that they don't like that Joe Biden has put up. And, you know, Mike Lee specifically was treating Merrick Garland like he was there for a Supreme Court nomination, asking him what he thinks of the Second Amendment and how he would read this decision and how he would read that decision. And I'm like, fucking dude.
Do you know what the attorney general does?
Yeah. And then he had to explain to him in a case regarding gun stuff. He had to explain to him what an en banc hearing was and what merits were. And it was just, it was painful to watch and absolutely disingenuous, which most of the Republican questions were. There were some good Republican questions, most of them not so good. But there seems to be some support among Republicans for advancing Merrick Garland out of the Judiciary Committee. I think Lindsey Graham and John Cornyn of Texas will likely vote for his advancement out of that committee. But that those are just beans.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think when he comes to the full Senate, I think Merrick Garland gets 70 plus votes.
I concur. And there were a couple of standout moments today. The opening statement, we got the opening statement early. We all read the opening statement. He delivered it, and he promised to keep the Justice Department independent. And he did this not only in his opening statement, but, under questioning, particularly Ted Cruz, who asked him whether he'd be Biden's wingman, which was a dig at a 2013 comment from Barack Obama about Eric Holder. And Garland responded, "I'll do everything in my power, which I believe is considerable, to fend off any effort by anyone to make prosecutions or investigations partisan or political in any way. My job is to protect the Department of Justice and its employees and going about their job and doing the right thing according to the facts and the law." And I imagine that career prosecutors, line professionals, lawyers, and employees of the Department of Justice today were just in tears watching this.
Applauding the TV. Yeah, this is why I will never be appointed nominated to be Attorney General or the Supreme Court. Because if I'd gotten that question from Ted Cruz, I would have stood up, looked him in the eye and said, Bill Barr! Yeah. Bill Barr! And my answer to every single fucking question would just be like, no! Did you see the monster we had in here for the past 2 years?
How long have you been in Cancun?
Yeah.
Mr. Cruz?
You're asking me about a joke about being the wingman from somebody who omitted the word not in his summary of the Mueller report in order to protect his buddy the president? Are you fucking kidding me? From somebody who appeared as the president's personal lawyer for 2 years and brought shame and disrepute to this office? Are you fucking kidding me? This is why I am not Joe Biden's nominee for the attorney general. But, you know, I think it should be.
Now, Chuck Grassley, Mr. Pigeon of Iowa, actually asked Garland whether he'd spoken to Biden about his son's case. I guess because, Trump spoke to Barr about a lot of his friends' cases, so it stands to reason. And Garland was like, no, I have not. The president made it clear in every public statement before and after my nomination that decisions about investigations and prosecutions will be left to the Justice Department. That was the reason I was willing to take this job.
Oh, I'm sorry. You appear to have mistaken me for Jared Kushner, who vetted every single thing that the...
I know. Sorry. I know you're angry.
It's all right.
It was a really nice... It was healing today. Now, Garland also prioritized investigating the siege on the Capitol, which he also did in his opening remarks when he was nominated a little while back. Senator Whitehouse encouraged Garland to look upstream and not rule out investigations of funders, organizers, ringleaders, or aiders and abettors who were not present at the Capitol on January 6th, who were not present at the Capitol on January 6th. We begin with the people, he said, and Merrick Garland said, yeah, we begin with the people on the ground. We work our way up to those who were involved and further involved. We will pursue these leads wherever they take us.
I thought it was encouraging in light of the somewhat unexpected and I think totally appropriate and very, very smart decision by the House managers to highlight the role of organizations like the Proud Boys in coordinating the January 6th insurrection. And I take this as an indication that combating right wing extremism is on the agenda of the Merrick Garland DOJ, as it should be.
Right. Well, Biden put Josh Geltzer,
yep,
a friend and guest of ours, in charge of assessing the need to develop policy regarding domestic violent extremism. They call it the DVE, right? And it's definitely a priority. And Garland made it clear today that investigating the insurrection was his top priority, as a matter of fact. I mean, aside from, you know, remaining independent and not being a wingman, Ted Cruz, Cancun Cruz. So that was, an interesting exchange, too. Garland also talked about changing his views on the death penalty since the Oklahoma City bombing. And I thought that this was really good. He said Monday I just want to let you know, because this show comes out Wednesday and this happened on Monday. Garland said he did not regret the execution of the perpetrator, Tim McVeigh, but he said that he had developed concerns about the death penalty in the 20 years since then. Due to some exonerations of those convicted, the arbitrariness and randomness of its application, and its disparate impact on Black Americans and other minority communities. Those are things that give me pause. So I thought that was really interesting. And he also said if Biden ordered a moratorium on the death penalty, then it would apply to all cases. But in response to a question from Tom Cotton of Arkansas, Garland said he had not yet considered whether to recommend to Biden an across-the-board commutation of death row inmates to reduce their sentences to life in prison.
Yeah, let's again point out that the moratorium that was lifted by Donald Trump on federal executions was put into place under the George W. Bush administration in 2003, that often some of the earliest and most vocal proponents of a moratorium on the death penalty came from Republicans who looked at the facts on the ground. And look, how you weigh the disparate impact point probably is a red-blue issue. How you weigh the unarguable high, unacceptably high rate of coerced convictions, I think crosses party lines. And I think I look at like the Innocence Project and the number of folks that we have ironclad exculpatory testimony in the form of DNA testing that, you know, proves that they were elsewhere at the time the crime was committed. And they've been able to prove numbers in the teens, right? In the like 10 to 15% range, which when you think about proving a negative, right, is strongly suggestive of a system that's broken.
Yeah. Well, and now that you're going to start seeing with some of the decisions, narrow as they have been, that people are going to start getting more access to the ballot. We could start looking at passing the John Lewis Voting Rights Act if we would only change the budget reconciliation rules to circumvent the filibuster. Now that people have gotten access to the ballot and they have tasted the right to vote where they had maybe perhaps been suppressed or oppressed in the past, it's hard to put that toothpaste back in the tube. And this might sound a little extreme, but the Republicans have long relied on small-time felonies to put away and to incarcerate people of color and communities of color to take away and strip their right to vote. And I think that you're going to see an amplification, including and up to and including the death penalty, of that kind of mass incarceration. You're going to see this battle, I think, going on now, because that's really now the only one. Now that, you know, we've gotten access to the ballot, or more access to the ballot, I should say, we're not anywhere near where we should be. But now that we're starting to see the light at the end of the tunnel, they're going to really push, I think, really hard on really tough, let's just say mass incarceration to try to limit the Democratic voting community. I think they're going to start looking at that. And I think that's why Garland got all these questions today about that. And I think that's why you're seeing some of the stuff come out of Clarence Thomas's mouth as well.
I hope you're wrong, but fear you're right.
Yeah, well, all we can do is keep fighting, right? Now, Garland on the Durham probe. And here's what's interesting. It would have been super simple for him to commit to not firing Durham.
Yeah.
Right? But he wouldn't do it. He wouldn't commit to not firing Durham, but says he sees no reason that the Durham investigation wouldn't go forward. Tom Cotton pressed Garland to explain why he couldn't pledge to give Durham the resources he needed. Ted Cruz, hammered him for a long time. Why can't you? So, you know, Barr promised not to fire Mueller, or no, Sessions promised not to fire Mueller. Why can't you promise not to fire Durham? And he's like, look, just no, I'm not going to make any promises without having seen any facts, because that's how the independent Justice Department is supposed to operate. He said he needed to learn more about the investigation before he could make any commitments, but added he didn't have any reason to think that Durham should not remain in place, but he wouldn't commit to it.
Yeah. Isn't it refreshing to have somebody who is a nominee for a major executive branch office to answer questions honestly?
Yeah, it is very nice.
Because look, as we saw, right, that there's nothing to stop Merrick Garland from just lying to these folks, right?
They're not gonna, the way Barr did.
Yeah, exactly. They're not gonna, you know, charge him with perjury. But I'm glad that our side doesn't do that, and I'm glad that while he's sitting there thinking, like, well, I don't know, maybe it is nonsense, I don't know a whole lot about it. Not going to put my thumb on the scale, but no, I'm not. Who the hell are you, Tom Cotton, for me to promise you who I'm going to fire or not fire?
Yeah, Ted Cruz, do you promise me you won't leave again for Cancun, or can I get a commitment out of you that you won't be a dick fucker for the rest of your life, or not?
Well, you're not going to get that kind of commitment, so.
No. And no offense to dick fuckers.
I was going to say that long and...
Okay. Now, The moment of the day.
Yeah.
For me was when Senator Cory Booker asked him, you know, tell us about why you're committed to being the kind of independent, fair, you know, equal justice under the law attorney general. Feel free to use, you know, your family background, et cetera. And the response was just, it's something that I think we will continue to see video of for many years into the future.
I agree, and I love that the trigger moment for Merrick Garland, right, in terms of becoming genuinely emotional, crying real tears, had to do with what we used to call the American story, right? Being a member of a minority group that was kicked out of every nation in Eastern and Western Europe, and understanding the value of inclusiveness. That did not used to be a blue state versus red state issue. It became as such under Donald Trump. And on my more optimistic days, I like to think that, you know, maybe that could become an American value again. It was also nice to see somebody in a confirmation hearing crying over something other than beer. So I thought that was good.
Do you drink, Senator? Yeah, no, he was talking about how his grandparents immigrated and they were persecuted, America protected them and welcomed them. And it would be his greatest honor to pay that back by being the attorney general you think I can become. And that's that humility. Just, it was stunning, and it was just a remarkable moment, absolutely remarkable moment. All right. Well, if you want to see video of that, by the way, we'll put that. We can probably stick that up on the Patreon page, right? And yeah. You can also get it on my Twitter feed if you follow at Mueller She Wrote, or I tweeted it out from there and from my personal account, Allison Gill. I was just totally stunned and floored by the absolute beauty of that moment. So I would check it out if you get a chance. It's only about a minute long. We'll be right back because we have some people to say bye-bye to. So stick around, and we'll be right back after this break.
Hi, I'm Harry Littman, host of the Talking Feds podcast, a weekly roundtable that brings together prominent figures from government, law, and journalism for a dynamic discussion of the most important topics of the day. Most news commentary is delivered in 90-second sound bites that just scratch the surface of a new development. Not Talking Feds. Each Monday, I'm joined by a slate of Feds favorites and new voices to break down the headlines and give the insider's view of what's going on in Washington and beyond. We dig deep, but keep it fun. Plus sidebars detailing important legal concepts read by your favorite celebrities, such as Robert De Niro explaining whether the president can pardon himself, and Carol King explaining whether members of Congress can be disqualified from higher office, and music by Philip Glass. Find Talking Feds wherever you get your podcasts, and don't worry. As long as you need answers, the feds will keep talking.
And now we get to what is quickly becoming my favorite segment on the show. Although, you know, we got to dig a little deeper each week. It's time for goodbye to you.
Yes, it is. And we begin with the continued exodus of U.S. attorneys from the Department of Justice. As today, we learned that Ryan K. Patrick, lifelong Republican Party hack, the guy who was appointed to the bench by Rick Perry and then named U.S. attorney for the Southern District of Texas by Trump in 2017, will resign effective February 28th. What's super gross about Patrick is that his departure press release, which he clearly wrote himself, Patrick praises himself as a prominent leader of the ever-increasing immigration debate.
Yeah, that announced that he was proud of the resources he diverted to border cases, his 96% conviction rate, and the fact that his office charged 25,000 defendants during his 3-year stint as U.S. attorney. So, bye-bye. Joining Patrick, and I mean, look, we can't do all these guys individually, are Matthew G.T. Martin of the Middle District of North Carolina. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Michael Bailey, Arizona.
Bye-bye.
Jason Dunn from Colorado.
You burnt.
Kenji Price of Hawaii.
Bye-bye.
Ron Parsons from South Dakota.
Bye-bye.
And Donald Q. Cochran of the Middle District of Tennessee. And I mentioned Q not just because of the Q middle name, but that's the only way you can find him on Wikipedia. Not a whole lot to know about most of these guys, but hey, they were Trump appointees, so bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Goodbye to you. And now that Biden is president, we can also restock the bench. So Connecticut Governor Ned Lamont announced late last week that he was appointing three assistant U.S. attorneys, Michael Gustafson, Gordon Hall, and Nitti Moses, for judgeships of the Connecticut Superior Court. Good luck to those future judges, and a rare, sincere goodbye from us.
Yeah. And finally, this is a great story. So you previously broke in episode number one how Biden, on day one, dismissed the Trump-appointed CEO for the U.S. Agency for Global Media, Michael Pack. Pack is a real scumbag who faced complaints from more than 30 whistleblowers during his tenure as head of the U.S. AGM. And true to Trumpian form, Pack's response was to fire the whistleblowers and retaliate against anyone in the agency whom he perceived as being insufficiently pro-Trump. So glad he's gone.
Right. Bye-bye. And now we've learned that Biden isn't just sacking Pack. He's bringing back the previously fired high-level whistleblowers, including Deputy Director of Operations Matt Walsh, Chief Strategy Officer Sean Powers, Chief Financial Officer Grant Turner, General Counsel David Kilgerman, I believe is how you say that, and Executive Director Owen Tran, and Bei Fang, head of Radio Free Asia.
Yeah, let's see. Already done Patti Smythe, so maybe this needs the theme from Welcome Back, Cotter.
Welcome back.
There we go. Welcome back.
Welcome back. Yeah. Wonderful. So, comings and goings. It's nice to say bye-bye, but it's good to say hello.
Love it.
All right. Well, that, I think, wraps us up for episode 6 this week of Clean Up on Aisle 45. I would highly recommend you check out Opening Arguments with Andrew, and you can check out my other show, The Daily Beans with Dana Goldberg. And of course, I would love if you could join Andrew and me every Tuesday at 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern on the Stereo app. It is a free app. Just download it. Go to stereo.com/AllisonGill. Search for myself and Andrew Torres. You can ask us questions, have an adult beverage or a non-adult beverage, whatever your gig is, and we'll be there singing, having a good time. Sometimes we dance. Who knows? A lot of weird stuff.
A lot of weird stuff. Yeah. Follow. She's at Allison Gill, and I am at Torres, T-O-R-R-E-Z. Apparently, I was the first Torres they led onto Stereo, so
ooh,
I was happy with that.
You're an early
at
adopter.
At least with a Z. Yeah.
Yeah, at least with the C, right? Everyone goes, you sure you're spelling that right? I'm like, yeah, pretty sure. Yeah.
When I get that question, and I get it not infrequently, it's I get to launch into the story of how my grandfather, when he emigrated here, knew that the S sound in Spanish was going to be like the Z sound. And yeah, but yeah.
Yeah, well,
that's
there
it.
You go.
We're done.
Mr. Torres, any final thoughts before we hang it up?
Nope. As always, love doing the show with you, and can't wait till we get to do the next one.
It's been a pleasure, and I can't wait for what was the new Supreme Court game show? Perception Supreme Court.
The Perception Supreme Court. Yeah.
Perception Supreme Court, where perception is 9/10 of the law. Hosted by Judge Clarence Thomas. It's going to be very good. It's going to be a good time. Thank you so much. I've been AG.
I'm AT. Have a good one.
And we'll see you next week on Clean Up on Aisle 45. Clean Up on Aisle 45 is written and produced by Allison Gill and Andrew Torres and is engineered and edited by Mackenzie Mizell and Starburns Audio. Fact-checking and research by Allison Gill and Andrew Torres with quality assurance and media by Muller She Wrote LLC. Branding, design, and logo by Starburns Audio and Joel Reeder with Moxie Design Studios. And our copy is written by Jesse Egan. Our music is written and recorded by Adam Orr and Christopher Hoffey, and our opening sequence is designed by Allison Gill and mixed by Mackenzie Mizell and Starburns Audio. Follow us on Twitter at Aisle45Pod and listen wherever you get your podcasts. Don't miss our Clean Up on Aisle 45 after party on the Stereo app. We'll be going live every Tuesday at 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 Eastern, and we want to hear from you. Our last Stereo show went a little bit like this.
I'll hit the button now. That's good. Hi there. Hey, I need a reality check, and maybe after all we've been through in the past 4 to 5 years, that is more than reasonable. But I'm worried that I'm being a little paranoid here, because I can't shake this feeling that the Axios story about the off-rails meeting that Axios story was planted to try to polish Trump's role in the insurrection, to remove some of the culpability for Trump believing the big lie, to move some of the blame off of Trump believing that he could fight for staying in the presidency on to Powell, maybe to claim that he was not at fault for his statements that the election was stolen and inciting the red insurrection, or to create some doubt about his guilt. Anyway, what are your thoughts about this? And by the way, I loved hearing Torres say the word fuck. That was perfect.
Thanks, Anka. Yeah, first of all, lots of media is planted. So to get that story of the off-the-rails meeting with Powell, feeding him all these ideas and riling him up, could be a plausible deniability type situation. I don't know. What do you think, Andrew? She's also just crazy.
Stereo is the app for live social conversations. We want to talk directly with you, the listeners. You can join our show, ask questions about news, politics, or anything. You can share your experiences and opinions. We want to hear it all. So download the app for free now and join us live this week, Tuesday at 5 Pacific, 8 Eastern. Link to our show in the description, and join us over on the Stereo app.
They might be giants that have been on the road for too long.
Too long.
And they might be giants aren't even sorry.
Not even sorry.
And audiences like the shows too much.
Too much.
And now they might be giants are playing their breakthrough album, Flood.
All of it.
And they still have time for other songs.
They're fooling around.
Who can stop They Might Be Giants and their liberal rock agenda?
Who?
No one.
This ad was paid for with somebody else's money.
I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.